Welcome to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Welcome to everyone, especially to all of our first-time listeners worldwide. Today is Tuesday, broadcasting out of Yakima, Washington, and guest speaker Janet Schwartz from Columbus, Indiana, keeping history alive. How's everybody doing today? Welcome to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Welcome to everyone, especially to all of our first-time listeners worldwide. Today is Tuesday. If you have a product or business, you can bring it into doitallinthemall.com, where all entrepreneurs can be found under the client's carousel on the homepage of Do It All in the Mall. Do It All in the Mall has been in business for over 13 years and is a secure 24/7 online shopping mall of over 5,000 stores for all your needs. You can shop for anything you need, all while listening to entertainment, all in your own comfort. You can make a difference worldwide. Take a tour and shop. We'll then be ready for discussion. In the meantime, call us at 845-241-9985. And now, we'll hear from our speaker today.
Good evening. This is Janet Schwartz. Welcome to tonight's program, Keeping History Alive. The title is, Life Tried to Beat Them, But They Beat Back. And tonight we're going to talk about the journey of reconciliation. We're going to talk about Fannie Lou Hamer, and we're going to talk about James Meredith. And wow, do we have a lot of information to give to you tonight. Now, my co-host today is Sandy Norris, and Sandy's voice is a little bit out, so she's going to try to speak, but there might be times when she can't. So Sandy, go ahead and say hello and tell us how you're doing.
I'm sorry, I had to mute it. Go ahead. Okay, Sandy, go ahead, start over. I apologize, I had to mute it.
Okay, my name is Sandy, and I'm going to do my best to help out tonight. I do have a problem with my throat. I think it's strep, but we all know that God is bigger than anything. So I'm sure he's going to help me try to help Janet speak tonight and get our point across.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Amen. We will do our best tonight because we got a great show lined up here. All right,
yes,
call us, 845-241-9985, because we want to be ready to speak to you. Please call 845-241-9985. Now, we have a couple clips to play. The first one is about...
Go ahead, Dad, and say that again.
On this day, April 23rd, 1947, Bayard Rustin and George Hauser were the principal organizers of the first Civil Rights Freedom Ride through the South. They titled it The Journey of Reconciliation. Two organizations were the ride's principal sponsors. The first was CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and the second was the Fellowship for Reconciliation. 16 men, 8 black and 8 white, embarked on the journey of reconciliation, created to force the United States to uphold the 1946 Supreme Court ruling that declared segregated seating unconstitutional. Morgan versus Virginia was a landmark decision with a 6-1 ruling in favor of desegregation, declaring segregation on interstate buses illegal. However, when they rode through Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Judge Henry Whitfield had some of them arrested. Ignoring the Supreme Court ruling, he sentenced the blacks to 30 days and the whites to 6 months on the Carolina chain gang. This has been a Breath of My Ancestors Minute, brought to you by the Institute of Radical Reconciliation. We must never forget. For more information, follow us at Ty Grayel on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For bookings, workshops, and current events, go to tygrayel.com.
Men, eight white. We had a group of men, eight white, eight black, who decided that they were going to see, yes.
Janet, go ahead and start over again. You weren't coming through.
Okay. So yes. The journey of reconciliation. Basically, you had a team of black and white activists in 1947, and they rode together in buses from Washington, D.C., through Virginia, North Carolina, and Kentucky to test the case of Morgan versus Virginia. Now, we talked about Irene Morgan the last time we were here, that in 1946, she was on a bus and was asked to move to the back for a white person to sit down in her place, and she refused to do that. And her case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and she won. So what the ruling was that segregated seating in interstate public transportation was unconstitutional because it violated the Commerce Clause. So first of all, let's talk a second here about the Commerce Clause. When the founders wrote the Constitution, they had to address the problem of interstate trade barriers from one location to another. And so they came up with the Commerce Clause, which grants Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among several states and the Indian tribes. Basically, only Congress and not the states can make laws that segregate or integrate interstate passengers. Because Morgan versus Virginia prohibited segregation in interstate travel as unconstitutional because it put an undue burden on commerce, that people moving back and forth from the states were considered part of the commerce. And so Morgan versus Virginia, Irene Morgan, when she refused to give up her seat, that's what the ruling was, that it was unconstitutional to segregate. And so these men, eight white and eight black, decided to test that out, if the courts were really going to uphold this and if the states were going to uphold this. So, again, they rode together in buses from Washington, D.C., through Virginia, North Carolina, and Kentucky to test Morgan versus Virginia. And they did. And obviously they got into a lot of trouble. The journey of reconciliation was supposed to be a nonviolent direct action to test the compliance within the Supreme Court's decision desegregating interstate travel. And eventually these men were arrested. And I want to quote here what the judge said to the men that were arrested. Even though it was unconstitutional, they still got arrested for doing what they were doing. Now, they went before Judge Henry Whitfield, and I want to quote this from one of the books that I have, and it says, Judge Henry Whitfield, a hardline segregationist, approvingly issued a guilty verdict assessing Bayard Rustin, court costs, and sentencing another man to 30 days on a road gang. So the blacks, he sentenced to 30 days on the chain gang, if you want to put it that way. Explaining the differential treatment, he termed the black men as poor, misled N-words from the North who bore less responsibility than that white agitators who should know better and later added a dash of anti-Semitism to his admonition. Quote, "I presume you're Jewish, Mr. Rodensky," one of the men who was on the journey, drawled the judge. "Well, it's about time you Jews from New York learned that you can't come down here and bring your N-words with you to upset the customs of the South." So he felt that the whites should have known better than to do this, so he sentenced them to a much longer thing, a much longer duration on the chain gang. So we also have a clip about Fannie Lou Hamer, and I think we were going to throw that into the mix here before we start our discussion. So if we could go ahead, let's listen to our clip on Fannie Lou Hamer.
Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America?
The former sharecropper who became a key voice in voting rights. Meet Fannie Lou Hamer. Born in Montgomery County, Mississippi in 1917, Fannie Lou quit school at 12 to work full-time in the fields. She eventually married and settled down on the same plantation she'd been raised on. Everything changed when she went to a civil rights meeting organized by her church.
I'd never heard until 1962 that black people could register and vote.
So at 45, Fannie Lou tried to do just that.
I went down the 31st of August to try to register. And after I had gotten back home, Mr. Marlowe told me that I would have to go down and withdraw my registration or leave, because they wasn't ready for that in Mississippi.
She made her choice.
As soon as I was fired from that plantation, I started right away then working on voter registration.
In June of 1963, she was arrested in Mississippi when the group she was with was refused service at a cafe. Once she was in jail, a state highway patrolman instructed two inmates to beat her.
"You used the curse word. And he said, we're going to make you wish you was dead."
She was left with permanent eye and kidney damage, but her resolve never wavered. By 1964, she had helped register 64,000 black Americans. Fannie went on to join forces with Martin Luther King Jr. and even spoke at the 1968 Democratic Convention. The next year, Fannie Lou founded the Freedom Farm Cooperative to support black farm workers in Mississippi. For the next 8 years, that would be her focus until she lost her battle with breast cancer in 1977. But Fannie Lou Hamer will be forever known as a woman who never stopped fighting for her rights and the rights of so many of her fellow black Americans.
Your freedom is shackled and chained to mine. And until I am free, you are not free either.
Okay, so we heard about Fannie Lou Hamer, and we're going to hear more about her later on. So let's go ahead and have some discussion about the journey of reconciliation. And I find it interesting that here it took eight men to test this out, that they wanted to see, you know, are the states going to comply with this? And you would think if there was a federal judgment that the states would automatically comply. And they didn't, as they saw from going on this journey of reconciliation. And it was meant to be a peaceful, nonviolent way to test the waters, if you will, after the example of Mahatma Gandhi. And there were many people in the early days of seeking civil rights that took after Mahatma Gandhi and his way of doing things with nonviolence, and making your impact in a nonviolent way. Now, Sandy, if you're there, if you can talk, I know you probably can't talk a lot, but what are some of your thoughts on what we just talked about with the journey of reconciliation?
There is something that I would like to say. There were several people, there were several people involved in this whose names were never mentioned, and I want to plant some names in your lap so that you can hear some of the other people. We all know the ones that were the great leaders, but we don't all know the people that were with them to make it happen. And so one was George Hauser, another was James Peck, another was Dennis Banks, another was Andrew Johnson, another was Conrad Lynn, another was Wallace Simonson, another was Eugene Stanley, another one was William Worthy, another one was Nathan Wright, another was Lewis Adams, another was Ernest Boonley, another was Joseph Bummett, another was Homer Jack, another one was Rawls Randall, another one was Igor Rodrigo. I think that these names should go down in history too, because as Jenna had just explained, the blacks got 30 days, but the whites got 6 months rather for participating in this freedom ride. And they didn't complain, they didn't say anything. They just challenged the state segregation laws on the interstate buses to the southern United States. And the early organizers of the two-week journey that began on April 9th, 1947. I just thought it was important to name some of the other names that made this happen, because it couldn't have happened without all of them.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for sharing those names. Obviously, and again, I just want to emphasize they went through this peacefully, but yet after getting arrested, the blacks were sentenced to 30 days on hard work on a hard labor chain gang, whereas the whites were sentenced to 6 months. I can't imagine just even 30 days being away from your family like that and having to do hard work because you're standing up for what you know is to be right, that you know by law that you're right. And that even though you're right, you're up against a system that is still telling you, no, you're wrong. You're not going to get away with this. So it's admirable what these men did to stand up to the interstate laws. Now, go ahead, Sandy.
I said there were also women involved as well, not just the men. I mean, we focus on them, but there were many women who were supporting the efforts of the men. And if it weren't for the women, it may not have gone as well as it did either. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Sure. Yes, absolutely. Thank you. All right. We have a song coming up. We want to listen to what's called the Reconciliation Song. So go ahead and play the song.
Let us be the generation of reconciliation and peace, and let us be a holy nation where pride and prejudice shall cease. Let us speak the truth in love to the lost and least of these. Let us serve the Lord in unity so others will believe. Let us be the generation of reconciliation and peace.
Singing the Reconciliation Song from the Gospel Praise album. We heard one clip about Fannie Lou Hamer, and we're going to hear another clip, but I want to remind you to call us at 845-241-9985. That's 845-241-9985. We have a second clip about Fannie Lou Hamer that we're going to listen to, and then we're going to really get into some things, some really interesting things about her and what she did for the civil rights movement. So let's go ahead and listen to the next clip called Fannie Lou Hamer Was Beaten by Mississippi Police in 1963 for Registering to Vote. Let's listen to that.
And they, you know, when I walked in with the two white men that had carried me down, and they cursed me all the way down. They would ask me questions, and when I would try to answer, they would tell me to hush. And when I walked inside of the booking room, one of the policemen went over and jumped up on one of the Negro's feet that was with us, and then they just began to, you know, put us in cells. And I was put in a cell with Miss Yvester Simpson, and after I was put in this cell, I could just hear some horrible screams and horrible sounds, you know, of licks. And I saw one of the girls was 15 years old, was with us. And she passed my cell, and she was real bloody. And then they asked the little man that cleaned up the jail to go inside and mop up that blood. And then I heard some more screaming, and I heard some awful sounds. And I would hear somebody when they say, "Can't you say yes, sir, nigger? Can't you say yes, sir?" And they would call her names that I wouldn't want to go on tape. And she said, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, and she said, "I don't know you well enough." And I would hear when she would hit the floor again. And finally she began to pray, and she asked God to have mercy on these people because they didn't know what they was doing. And after a while they passed my cell door with this young woman, Miss Annelle Ponder, and one of her eyes looked like blood, and her hair was standing up on her head, and her clothes had been torn from the shoulder down to the waist. And then three white men came to my cell, and one of them was a state highway patrolman because he was wearing a little silver plate across his pocket that said John L. Bassinger. And he asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Louisville, and he said, "I'm going to check that." And he went out, and I guess he called Louisville, and they didn't like me in Louisville because I worked with voter registration there. And when he came back, he said, "You damn right." They said, "You're from Louisville, all right, and we going to make you wish you was dead." And they led me out of that cell into another cell, and he gave a Negro prisoner a blackjack, and he ordered me to lay down on a bunk bed. And a Negro prisoner said, "Do you want me to beat her with this, sir?" And he said, "You damn right, because if you don't, you know what I'll do for you." And I laid down on the bunk like he ordered me to do. And the first Negro beat me. He beat me until he was exhausted. And after he beat, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. And during the time he was beating, I began to work my feet because that was a horrible experience. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro that had beat to sit on my feet while the second one beat. And I just began to scream where I couldn't control it. And then the white man got up and began to beat me in my head. I have a blood clot now in the artery to the left thigh and a permanent kidney injury on the right side from that beating. These are the things that we go through in the state of Mississippi, just trying to be treated like a human being.
Fannie Lou Hamer. And that happened only 58 years ago. Think about that. Let that sink in, that wasn't so long ago. What an atrocious thing to have happened to someone who was just standing up for what was right. Because you remember, we talked about this a while back, that blacks had the vote back in the 1860s. Actually, the 1870s, that blacks were able to have the vote according to the 15th, the 14th and 15th Amendment. But what happened was the whites forced these literacy tests on them, and it turned away and disenfranchised a lot of blacks. And as you can hear from this particular clip, that many were beaten if they even tried to register to vote. So this, you know, standing up for what's right and listen to her own words about being viciously beaten. And she worked on a plantation. She was the one who could read and write. So she was put ahead. She had a higher position. So when Mr. Marlowe said, "You either unregister to vote or you're done for, you're not going to work here anymore," she had a pretty high position there on the plantation. So that was a big decision to leave and to start over. She and her husband moved to what's called Ruleville, R-U-L-E-V-I-L-L-E, Ruleville. That's what she was referring to in the clip. So she was fired from the plantation. She tried to register. She led 17 volunteers to register to vote on August the 31st of 1962. And she was brutally beaten in jail for doing that, sitting in a whites-only bus station and also taking those people to register to vote. What's interesting, too, is that in 1964 at the Democratic National Convention, she spoke, and she was listening. She was telling the people what she went through, and President Johnson didn't want, I mean, I don't mean to put him down here, but it's true that he didn't want people hearing her message, so he decided to hold a conference that all the networks had to switch to when it was Fannie Lou Hamer's turn to speak. But that backfired because they felt that her testimony was so compelling that they rebroadcast it that evening. So everyone, she broadcast, because they broadcast it later in the evening, there were more and more people who were able to hear her message. So she was an organizer. She worked with the Students for Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's called the SNCC. And, you know, one of the things that I want to bring up about her is what started her to go for civil rights. And believe it or not, what started it all was the fact that she had received what was called a Mississippi appendectomy. And that was the forced sterilization of black women without their knowledge. And I want to read here from a book, because that's what got, this is, when you hear what I'm about to read, this is what got her started in seeking out civil rights. So I feel like it's an important thing, a part of history to hear. And this is referring to Fannie Lou Hamer. It says, she might easily have endured the life of a quiet desperation dictated by her birth, then vanished without a ripple. The granddaughter of a slave, the daughter of sharecroppers, and younger sister to 19 siblings, she was intelligent, hardworking, and loved to read, but she was also dark-skinned, uneducated, and a woman, a recipe for failure in rural Mississippi. The year was 1961, but it might as well have been 1861. She helped her family eke a hardscrabble existence on a plantation in Sunflower County by picking 300 to 400 pounds of cotton a day for $1 a hundredweight. They spent their days exhausted, hungry, and shabbily garbed, but her family never earned enough to break the cycle of debt and remained trapped in latter-day slavery called sharecropping. But she was not angry. A deeply religious person, she focused her energies on helping others and eagerly awaited the day she would have her own family. Her name was Fannie Lou Hamer. One day in 1961, Hamer entered the hospital to, quote, have a knot on my stomach, unquote, probably a benign uterine fibroid tumor, removed. She then returned to her family's shack on the plantation to recuperate. But in the big house, ominous tidings circulated. The owner's wife, Vera Alicia Marlowe, was a cousin of the surgeon who had treated Hamer. Marlowe gossiped to the cook that Hamer had lost more than a tumor while unconscious. The surgeon had removed her uterus, rendering Hamer sterile. The cook repeated the news to others, including a woman who happened to be Hamer's cousin, and thus Hamer was one of the last people on the plantation to learn that she would never have a family of her own. I went to the doctor who did that to me, and I asked him why. Why had he done this to me? He didn't have to say nothing, and he didn't. If he was going to give that sort of operation, then he should have told me. I would have loved to have children. But a lawsuit was out of the question, Hamer recalled. At that time, me getting a white lawyer against a white doctor, I would have been taking my hands and screwing tacks in my casket. And this is what got her started on civil rights. This was called a Mississippi appendectomy, and a lot of poor black women back in the days of segregation underwent this without their knowledge. So I thought that was important to read to you because, you know, this is an unknown piece of history that a lot of people don't know about. And I read from the book called Medical Apartheid, APARTHEID, Medical Apartheid by Harriet A. Washington. You can actually get the book on Amazon. We'll have a link on the website to it, and you can look up that book. So that's what got her started, and as you can see from what we heard, she went through many, many hardships, to say the least, to get to where she was by the time her life ended. So, Sandy, do you have anything that you wanted to add to this?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, if you can hear me, I wanted to
yes,
say
we can hear you.
That she brought the civil rights struggle in Mississippi to the attention of an entire nation during a televised session at the convention. And the next year she ran for Congress in Mississippi, but she was unsuccessful in her bid. And along with her political activism, she worked to help the poor and families in need in her Mississippi community. And she also set up organizations to increase business opportunities for minorities and to provide child care and other family services. And she died, of course, of cancer on March 14, 1977. And her tomb reads, "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired." That's what's on her tombstone.
Wow. "I am sick and tired of being sick and tired" on her tombstone. Thank you so much, Sandy, for sharing that.
You know,
we have
Janet,
Mr. Parks with us.
Janet, can
Go
I jump
ahead.
In before we bring on Mr. Parks? You know, hearing that clip and hearing, what did they beat her with? What was that called again? And what is it? Do you know?
It's called a blackjack. And it looks like two batons that are attached together by a chain, if I have that right. Maybe Mr. Parks can clarify that for me, what a blackjack is. But I saw a picture of it, and that's what it looked like, two batons, police batons, that were attached together using a chain.
Kind of like what they have in karate. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, it was sort of like back then. They don't use those these days and stuff, but back then they used was a leather object and stuff that was something rolled up in it and shaped, you know, so that they can, it was easily, it would swing back and forth. And they hurt, you know. They really hurt.
Mm.
Thought it would have a recoil on it. So that's what they used to rouse people up with and beat them with the blackjack.
Mm. Wow.
Well, you know, and it was just really hard to listen to that and just imagine yourself being held down, your feet, and being whipped. And it's just really hard to see or understand how anyone would do that. What did they not have in their heart and their body to say to them, this is wrong? I mean, I don't see how I could stand there and hurt somebody and not have any feelings about it.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And, it was someone of her own color that they forced to beat her.
Yeah, it was.
Mr. Parks, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, it was a sign of the time. That's why that's how black people were treated, and that was to get instant response. You know, they had to send a message.
Mm.
That was the whole thing about the whole deal. You know, these people and stuff, they're going to violate what we say that they can't violate, and they're going to get out here anyway. And that was the message. There wasn't no civility in it whatsoever, just put a hurt on them. They didn't, in a lot of cases, they didn't really try to kill them because they were just going to send a message with all of this brute force that we're going to put on you, then maybe that's going to dissuade you and anybody else that want to come out, you know. So that was the message.
Yeah. Wow, what a message. I mean, it reminds me of Christ in the Bible being beaten to the point of death, but not quite. I'm sure it was a lot like that. It had to be beaten to the point. They're going to send a message. I bet they beat them to the point where they weren't dead, if I had to guess right. Okay, go ahead.
No, well, it's happening more subtle now, you know, with all of the deal that's going on surrounding voting and who should have the right to vote. You know, well, instead of beating you in the streets, so to speak, then they are gerrymandering, you know, and
they have
control of, they're cutting the districts up so that the indigenous people that are heavily populated in one district won't get the vote. You know, they don't get to say who their leaders can be. And that's one thing that's happening all over the United States, of course, with the 10-year redistricting deal, which is just about over, but that's what we're facing here. It's just oppression. That's what it is. More force, more force and power, okay? More force and power because if the powers that be can control all of those districts and stuff where all of the funds are coming in, the government funds are coming through there, then they can map their own way of how they want to see things going. You know, not all of it is bad, but, you know, it don't give people of color, say, for example, here in Yakima, you got a large Hispanic population, and in their district where they're more or less predominant in their district and stuff, they just got the right to elect a council person 2 years ago.
Wow.
I'm talking about 75 to 80%. What the city did was they created another charter where that they could elect a council person at large so that they didn't have to live in this district, you know, and they stole the power. So it's just another form of suppression, really. It's a great topic.
Yeah, I never thought of it that way, the gerrymandering. We have a song coming up. Before we play it, though, I want to remind everyone to call us, 845-241-9985. We have a song coming up here about Fannie Lou Hamer, so let's go ahead and listen to that song.
Woke up this morning with my mind. Singing.
Up This Morning by Fannie Lou Hamer off of an album called Songs My Mother Taught Me. Great song. Call us 845-241-9985. We're going to talk next about James Meredith, a name that you probably never heard of, but after tonight you're going to know a lot about him. So we have some clips about James Meredith, 3 clips, and let's go ahead and listen to them.
This is the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. On June 5, 1966, 32-year-old James Howard Meredith was waiting the arrival of other supporters of his march against fear to begin. He had planned to walk from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi, a distance of some 220 miles. It was around 1:45 p.m. and only a few supporters had arrived, so the march started early. There was no major civil rights leaders supporting this march, and at the beginning, hardly no security at all. Even though only 4 years earlier, James Meredith had been instrumental and desegregating the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss. The little group of marchers left the Peabody and over to Beale Street and then on to Highway 51. Meredith wanted to encourage the black population of Mississippi to register and vote without fear. They walked down Highway 51, walking past Graceland, the home of Elvis. They continued walking until they got within 1/4 mile of the Mississippi state line, somewhere in this vicinity. They were informed that a large number of unruly crowd was waiting at the Mississippi state line. They were making threats against Meredith's life. It had to be broken up by the Tennessee Highway Patrol. Now the state line is down here at this red light. Meredith decided to continue the march the next day and was driven back that night to the Lorraine Motel to spend the night. The next morning on the 6th, he crossed into Mississippi. Now we're taking the same route down 51 that the Meredith party took. He refused to call it a march. He said that a march was a demonstration. And this was not a demonstration. But he wanted to show that a black man could walk anywhere he wanted to in Mississippi. As he reached Mississippi, the threats grew stronger. Men would drive by, shouting threats and slurs, blowing horns and waving Confederate flags, and shouting, "You'll never reach Jackson alive." The Mississippi Highway Patrol and the FBI agents riding in cars back behind the marchers there was still no major civil rights leaders participating in this walk. And this is the walkers as they entered Hernando, Mississippi, some 30 miles south of Memphis. The marchers, you could see, was very thinly placed, and it was only a few. Now this is the walkers heading south toward Hernando. The walkers appeared to stay on the east side of the highway, walking facing the traffic, because he said it was his intent not to block traffic. The route led the marchers by Court Square in Hernando. Now this is Meredith talking to some of the residents in Hernando. The march finally continued on down Highway 51. Some 3 miles or so, the march had passed what's now known as North Belmont Road, and some 100 yards or so south of Belmont Road, the unthinkable happened. Now we are now at that spot, looking back up north, 51, towards Hernando. Where in 1966, there was a small store on Belmont Road, and a lot of the reporters and marchers had actually stopped there to get food and drink. However, Meredith continued walking on ahead. Now, it's where this car, you can see the car that was coming out on off of Belmont Road onto Highway 51. Now, Meredith was walking on the other side of the highway from us, and he was walking towards us. And when he had reached this spot, a shot rang out. It came from behind bushes and honeysuckle vines. It was Aubrey Norville, an unemployed hardware clerk from Memphis, had shot James Meredith. Meredith fell to the pavement. He could actually see the gunman hiding in the weeds. Wounded, he tried to crawl to the other side of the road away from the shooter. He was hollering for help. He was struck 2 more times by a shotgun blast. Reaching finally this side of the highway, the west side, and then collapsing. Ironically, it seemed that no one tried to help James Meredith at the critical time. The shooter simply walked off and later, of course, was apprehended, offered no resistance, and was quickly arrested. He gave no reason for his action. He had parked his 1963 Bonneville Pontiac in the driveway up there where the blue garbage cans are, and he walked back down through the woods to wait on the Meredith party. James Meredith, of course, was rushed to the hospital where surgeons removed some 70 or more pellets from his back, legs, and shoulders. And he still carries some of those pellets that couldn't be removed to this day. The next day, civil rights leaders from all over rushed to Meredith's bedside, such as Dr. Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, and others. The civil rights movement was basically dying in 1966. And this was the sort of thing that was just needed to revive the movement. Now they quickly took over the march with a lot of disagreement between the different organizations. Meredith, even after he recovered from his wounds, refused to join the march until it reached Jackson. James Aubrey Norville pleaded guilty to assault and battery with intent to kill. He was sentenced to 5 years with 3 years suspended. He was released from the Mississippi State Prison at Parchment after serving only 18 months. But he was the first white man to serve any time at all in a Mississippi prison for shooting a black man. Norville has never explained why he shot James Meredith, or why he used birdshot instead of the regular shotgun shells that would have done more damage. James Meredith later lost favor with the civil rights movement for doing such things as supporting Governor Ross Barnett for re-election, the very same governor that had tried to block his entrance into Ole Miss. He also supported numerous Republican candidates. He marched against black-on-black crime. He also thought that the liberal movement was actually hurting the black cause in America. Now, I believe the United States Air Force that Meredith entered in 1951 at the age of 18 had a great influence on him, as I believe the military had also an influence on his friend, Medgar Evers. Not only did it teach him discipline, but socially, the military was far more advanced than the general public. And I believe that it showed Meredith what America could be instead of what others believed it was. Now, the importance of this march accomplished, in my opinion, more than any other civil rights movement for the blacks in this country, more so than all the other accomplishments combined, I believe, because it brought federally armed marshals to register voters in Mississippi, which, of course, later on applied to all states. Without this act, I believe that it would have been impossible for us to have now had a black president.
Okay, James Meredith, he was the first African-American student to be admitted to the University of Mississippi, otherwise known as Ole Miss. His goal was to put pressure on the Kennedy administration to enforce civil rights, so he decided to test that out, see if they would enforce it by trying to be the first African-American to be admitted to Ole Miss. And the march that was talked about was in 1966. But before we get to that, let's go back to the Ole Miss entrance here. The President Kennedy had to send down the National Guard to enforce him to be able to enforce the fact that he was supposed to be able to register for classes. So when James Meredith went to register for classes, he had the National Guard present to enforce that. And how he got through 4 years of college at Ole Miss without any real problems, I have no idea. I think people wonder to this day. Now, he is still alive, James Meredith. He's still around. You can find some clips of him talking on YouTube. Please do that when you have time. Now, the march that he was on, it was a solo march, just him, in 1966 from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi. And it was to highlight ongoing racism after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, that Voting Rights Act was supposed to take away a lot of barriers that were hindering African Americans from voting, like a literacy test and having to prove that you could read and write, and you had to answer some civics questions that these are questions that they didn't even give to the whites and that the whites probably couldn't even answer. So that Voting Rights Act took away those barriers for voting amongst African Americans. So here we have, he's on this solo march. He's shot on the second day. And after he's shot, the others joined into the march. So here we have a legacy of James Meredith, and we're going to hear some more clips about him. But there he is. He's still alive. He's a great civil rights activist. And like I said, he's the first African-American to be admitted to Ole Miss. So let's go ahead and Sandy. We have Sandy still with us, and again, her voice isn't so good, so I may have to repeat a few things that she says. We don't know here. But Sandy, what do you have to add to this?
Well, all I have to add, of course my voice is going now, is that
sure.
The fact that he was a former serviceman, and that did give him discipline and knowledge and education. And he was a very, very intelligent man. And when his admission was revoked from Ole Miss, as the registrar learned of his race, a federal court had to order Ole Miss to admit him. But when he tried to register on September 20th, 1962, he found the entrance to the office blocked by Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett. On September 28th, the governor was found guilty of civil contempt and was ordered to cease his interference with desegregation at the university or face arrest and a fine of $10,000 a day.
But
2 days later, Meredith was escorted, as Janet has already explained to us, onto the campus by the U.S. Marshals, setting off riots that resulted in the deaths of two students. But he returned the next day and began classes in 1963, and he was a transfer student from an all-black Jackson State College and graduated with a degree in political science. And I found that very interesting because he never, ever gave up. He'd been shot multiple times, and he stood back up and did what he wanted to do, and he was unstoppable. And to have an ancestor who has that type of unstoppable force, I think he deserves all of our honor and all of our glory and all of our respect, because there are a lot of people who would not have gone through all that for us, and he did it for us so that we could vote, so that we could be considered equal in school, so we could be considered equal as human beings. And one man did that for all of us. And that just is something that blows my mind. I didn't want to use that word, but that's all I could think of, to have one person love us so much, love his people so much, that he was willing to endure whatever he had to endure to make sure that we were educated, that we were disciplined, that we were able to vote, that we were treated equally in this country. And that's just, you know, when you think about just one person starting something like this, That's miraculous to me.
Yeah.
Yes.
Definitely. Yes.
You know,
you put it so well.
One thing about
go ahead.
About Mr. Meredith that a lot of people just still don't understand. You know, they're thinking, a lot of people I'm talking to, historians alike, are thinking that he was thinking about telling black people to integrate. That wasn't the message that Meredith was using. Come on, wake up. He was talking to black people and telling black people and stuff that you can achieve. You can become competitive. In fact, one of his quotes is, if black people use their resources properly, they can become competitive as any group in society. Take control of neighborhoods, businesses, schools, including teachers. The only thing keeping black people from doing it is the idiotic ideal about integration, about being racially balanced. Okay, just think about it. What happened and stuff after the end of the Civil War? Black people started heading from the South, going north and stuff, ended up in the bottleneck places and stuff when they had their own schools. Okay, all they had to do was stay put. They had their own property in a lot of cases and stuff. So when they uprooted, here you go. And another thing that he was trying to do is he was trying to get the Kennedy administration to do what? To send the soldiers and stuff. You know, he knew that was going to take. He knew that the power of the police forces in the South was not going to go up against, you know, the white power structure, because they were the white power structure. So that was his deal. To get them, and then he tried to get admitted there how many times before finally the Kennedys wanted to make a stand to be able to do that and then send the troops to make sure he was there. A lot of people still don't, they still fail to realize that, and a lot of black people right now sitting in the same place thinking that we need to be able to get 40 acres in a mule. No, we just need to show our strength and then do what is necessary for us to do. Hell, we spend enough money. Look at how much money black folks spend in the last 5 years and stuff. Trillions of dollars in the last 5 years. The only thing, when we spent that money, it didn't come back to us. And that's what everybody does now. You spend money and stuff in your community so it comes back to you. You know, this is an excellent piece, Janet, my sister. Hey, I'm going to have to go down, but people really need to know that. That's the deal about your history. Your history is great. I love it. Okay, but people need to know the real meaning of what it is that you're bringing to us, because it's powerful. You got a lot of people saying black folks don't need to know history and stuff, you know. Well, you need to know where you've been before you know where you're going. You know what I mean? And it ain't about all white folks not bad. All black folks ain't good, you know. So that was Meredith. And then what happened once he gets shot? Then you have all the civil rights leaders and stuff. They was already around anyway. Then here they come to take up the march, okay? Because they knew what them white folks were gonna do in Mississippi, okay? The home of the Ku Klux Klan. They was gonna kill somebody. Okay, hey ladies, that was a great piece.
Thank you. And thanks for being with us tonight. That was really cool for you to come on here. That's great, great insight that you've given us. We have a caller on the line. Caller with the last four digits.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. It's me.
Okay.
My name is Joe. How are you?
I'm doing good. Where are you calling from, Joe?
Montana.
Thank you so much for calling in. Do you have some thoughts that you'd like to say about what we've talked about, anything tonight?
Yeah, I just came by just a few seconds ago, and before I called in, and you picked up rather quickly, which was good. I know about a little bit about James Meredith. I didn't know that he was one that didn't support integration. I don't know for what particular reason, but it may have been for the fact that as the gentleman that was just finished talking about, and that when I've gone on black shows and when they keep talking about how white people keep them down and white supremacy, they can't define systemic racism. And I say to them, look, in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, what I understand, black people were doing exceptionally well. They had a nuclear family of which divorce rate was very low. The birth out of wedlock was only around 6% or so. The level of math and reading proficiency was pretty high. As a matter of fact, I think at one time there was an all-black school named Dunbar that had the highest rating in the country, and it was all black. And then after integration, for some reason, everything seemed to have fallen apart. So I don't know if integration is the cause or if it's just a correlation, but I do know that, as the gentleman was saying, that Meredith said that black people got their own resources, et cetera, money, they could be as competitive as anybody else. Well, history seems to show that. Unfortunately, there is also the history of Tulsa, where white, I don't know if it was Ku Klux Klan or just white townspeople, just decided upon themselves as a result of a false accusation of rape to bomb the city. Mm-hmm. But black people were fairly well off in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. I think the unemployment rate was also exceptionally low, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe you would know more about it than I would.
Yeah. No, you bring up some great points there about blacks doing well in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I'm not sure why he didn't support integration, but your explanation, it was awesome. I mean, it really brings in a lot of insight.
Well,
so,
that's just my speculation, you know. It just seems to me that 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, blacks were doing fine outside of the fact that they were forced not to integrate with whites. And, of course, no people who were born here in America or especially brought over here from Africa want to be treated as second-class citizens and to be told, you can't mix with us. So naturally, there's going to be an impetus for people to go, you can't tell me I can't go there. I pay taxes as well, which was why, what was it? Who was it that there was, I forget the name of the girl, and I think the guy, student, who entered one of the universities, and I forget. But that was the impetus for doing it. You know, you can't tell me in my own country what not to do. So, yeah, they wanted to integrate. Can't blame them. But I still like to find out, is integration the cause of the disintegration of blacks, or is it just a correlation? I don't particularly know.
Right.
I think it was both. It was both and stuff. If you look at, go back and study that era, it was both. You know, and then with the Brown versus
Board
of Education, it only spurred, you know, the civil rights movement, you know, in another way. That's because, of course, if you own a highway, you went to a hotel, you couldn't go to a hotel or restaurant or whatever. Of course, you know about the Green Pages and stuff, you know, the little green book that they published and stuff is a real good Well, it was a book and stuff published and stuff. If you were traveling through the South, there's different places and stuff for you to go. You know, if you
were black, the green book.
If you were black, then there was different places. But you know, his idea was that, why are we gonna pull uproot and leave from where we're going? Remember now, during this time, blacks had schools. The schools weren't as well kept as the white schools, but they had schools. They had black teachers. The whole deal was it was to try to let's build off this, okay, instead of everybody want to hop up and then leave and leave some place that you know to go to some place that's like the pie in the sky, and that's what the North was. It was a pie in the sky. When families got there and stuff, there ain't no jobs, okay? So, you know, that's what he was talking about. He was talking about trying to stay where you are. Let's do what we can. Let's fight this fight then, you know, within our community, you know, and create what Oklahoma did, okay? Fantastic town and stuff. Those guys were productive and they had a business sense, and they knew that one thing they had to do is they had to make emphasis on how they live. You know, the picket fence, the banks, the blacksmiths, the different shops and stuff, you know, in order to be able to do that, you know. And today, as a people, in my opinion, you guys, as a black people and stuff, we still have yet to realize and stuff what our true potential is. 44.5 million black folks in America only got 1% of the total wealth. I laugh at that when I think about it, you know. And then every day, you know, we see that. And then somehow a lot of black people is thinking that, oh, white folks are holding us down. No, 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 no. You know.
Well,
you,
as you I said, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You holding yourself down if you're a spy to even think about that. You know, you just got to get out there and bust your butt a little bit harder than everybody. Now, there are some cases, like I mentioned earlier and stuff, that when we get into this redistricting deal where you see, like, these districts have a large percentage of indigenous or people of color in there, and then they still don't have the right. I think, you know, they will eventually, if they keep fighting for the right to be able to govern themselves, you know. Well, that's what's happening. And I look at the government, what the government is doing too, the federal government is doing too, you know, the same token and stuff. If you got money and you got wealth, you could just about write your own ticket, you know. Like, look at the pandemic. The pandemic and stuff, every rich person in America got richer.
Okay.
The richest people in the world got a thousand times richer, you know. And then we can't come together to see how we live. But, okay, Janet, thank you.
Yeah, I got to jump in here. Joe, stay with us, okay? We got two more clips we're going to listen to. We got two more clips we're going to listen to about James Meredith. And we also have a song called Shot on Meredith. So let's listen to the next two clips about James Meredith.
What happened in 1962 at Ole Miss was a war between the state of Mississippi and the United States of America. I remember being outside playing and coming inside, and my parents' eyes were glued to the television. And I remember saying, "What are you all watching?" "Shh, shh, University of Mississippi is being integrated." And I looked at the television set, and all I can remember was seeing some real mean, foul-looking faces, very unwelcoming faces, and just sort of saying to myself, I would never go to a place like that.
America fought a little war on the night of September 30th, 1962, into the morning of October 1st, 1962. A small battle occurred in Oxford, Mississippi, on the campus of the university and in the city.
But those were some very tough and difficult times where people died.
getting James Meredith in here and registering in October of 1962 was not an easy thing. It was such a tough thing. It rose to the level where it was on the president's desk, where the president of the United States is having to be involved, and the Attorney General Bobby Kennedy having to send out federal marshals, 25 or 26 or so, to protect a man's life simply because he wanted to register for classes.
I was at war, and I knew I could win the war against Mississippi by only one means, and that was to get the federal government in position where they had to use their force to support my rights.
I think James Meredith was incredibly strategic, incredibly bright, and I don't know what sort of support system or guidance that he had to determine that the best way to beat the system was by using the system.
We often thought, how on earth did he study under those circumstances? Because we had fairly difficult circumstances to study under, we thought ourselves. And so we would always wonder, how on earth did he do it? And so in that sense, he kind of became our, and remained our hero.
James Meredith came to Ole Miss, you know, and he had a very, very different experience than I had. You know, people shooting at him, and, you know, other experiences that he had that I didn't have as a football player, you know. When I came along, I was a football player, I was protected as long as I played, as long as I knocked people's head off, it wasn't no problem with it.
James Meredith could have chosen a historically black college or university to attend and easily have gone there and been fine. But he chose to knock down the walls of segregation, and I look forward to continuing to pay tribute to him. He's a living a monument to that movement, and I'm glad that he had the courage to stand up then and allow us to have the opportunities today that we have.
You cannot have a second or a third or a 10,000 unless you have a first. There has to be a first. So there would not have been a Deuce McAllister or a Michael Orr if there was not a James Reed and a Ben Williams. There would not have been an Armenti Price unless there was a Peggy Gillum. There would not have been Otis Sanford, a Ronnie Agnew, a George Hillard, Edie Keller Green, a Makiva Morgan, unless there had been a James Meredith. And we all recognize that the opportunities that were afforded us, the opportunities to get a great education, to be a part of a wonderful alumni network, were all made possible by James Meredith.
And the integration of this university was one of the pivotal events that made this place go from a place to a university.
If you want to think of Americans who have done great and glorious things for our nation, look to Oxford, Mississippi. Look to the University of Mississippi. Look at James Meredith. Look at the federal marshals. Look at the Mississippi National Guardsmen who rescued the city that night and the city and the University of Mississippi, and look at the regular black troops and white troops who followed them in, marching through a wall of flame in one case, and you'll find gallantry, and you'll be inspired, I think, as an American. And if we understand what happened here that night, we can have a much better sense of what it means really to be an American when the stakes are so high, the risks are so great, the danger is so real, and the transformation is so inspiring.
Such significant events that led to somebody today simply walking into a classroom and sitting down with people of different ethnicities, that was not so simple then. And so the way we pay tribute to their legacy is by paying it forward.
James Meredith's legacy to me extends much further than just the realms of Ole Miss and Oxford and the state of Mississippi. I think his contributions in terms of opening the doors for black students and all students of color to attend a public university in the state of Mississippi have far-reaching implications in terms of where we stand today and the American public's ability to look beyond a person's skin tone and to look at them for their true merits and skills and abilities and to be able to make judgments about what their potential is.
One of the greatest compliments I've ever gotten, I remember our first meeting, he said, you know, I chose Ole Miss, but Ole Miss chose you. And that really meant a lot to me, coming from someone who had such courage and sacrificed his life to pave the way for others.
When I was elected president of the Ole Miss Alumni Association, it was an important moment for me and probably one of the greatest honors of my life. But one thing that made it even sweeter was to open my mail one day. And there was a letter from James Meredith who said, "I have been watching you. Your moment has come. I am proud of you. I have kept clips and pictures and stories about you. Be a great president."
This was a great turning point in American history, in the history of the Civil Rights Movement.
He made it possible that he was first, and we could honor that legacy by being the best students that we could be and being the best community servants that we could be.
We are who we are because of those people who came before us and paved a better way.
On June 6, 1966, civil rights activist James Meredith was shot and wounded in Mississippi. On the second day of his 220-mile march against fear, Meredith had successfully integrated the University of Mississippi 4 years earlier. He organized a one-man march from Memphis to Jackson, Mississippi, to encourage voter registration in the black community, challenging the culture of fear perpetuated by white supremacists. Although planned as a solitary march, Meredith was joined by a few friends and supporters, and they were followed by police. On day two of the march, Aubrey Norville, a white salesman, ambushed Mr. Meredith. He was shot in the neck, head, and back. Before shooting, Norville warned bystanders to disperse and twice shouted out Mr. Meredith's name. But the police did nothing to protect him. He survived his injuries, but Meredith was unable to immediately continue. So some civil rights leaders marched in his place, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Stokely Carmichael, and Floyd McKissick were among the thousands, including me, who completed the trip. Along the way, we were faced with harassment and physical abuse from angry mobs and law enforcement officers. Mr. Meredith was able to rejoin the march just before it ended in Jackson. And later that year, the would-be assassin, Aubrey Norville, pleaded guilty to assault and battery and was sentenced to 2 years in prison.
June 6, 1966. The shot came out down just like a dove. June 6, 1966. The shot came out down just like a dove. Mr. President, I wonder what are you gonna do now? I don't believe you gonna do nothing at all. He was marching through Mississippi, lead my people what he thought was right. He was marching through Mississippi, lead my people what he thought was right. The last I heard of my boy James Meredith, some evil man tried to take his life. I was looking at Dick Gerber this morning. He said, I'm here to take a play. I was looking at Dick Gerber this morning. He said, I'm here to take a play. The newspaper men asked him, what do you think you're gonna prove? He said, I'm gonna lead the people just like James Murders do.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that song. Actually, I mean, it's a song about what James Meredith went through. It's called Shot on Meredith by J.B. Lenoit, L-E-N-O-I-T. So let's, Joe, thank you. Welcome back. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Joe?
No.
Okay.
Just want to, I think, integration. I remember there was supposedly a quote from Lyndon Johnson, and he said, now, okay, as a result of the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Act, we now got the N-word voting Democratic for the next 100 years. So,
Wow.
You know, so it,
wow,
kind of makes people, kind of makes you wonder about how much, how effective were the Civil Rights movements during that during that era, because everybody should have had the right to vote. The Civil Rights Act granted that, but it seemed as though they just redirected the attention away from, you know, it was like a free card money. You direct the attention away from where the peanut really is, and you direct it someplace else. And so people now are waking up because people are realizing the Democrats in today's political climate aren't really pulling together to help America in general.
Right. Right. Thank you for sharing that. Those are some great points that you've made there. Mm-hmm. We need to do a whole show on that. But thank you so much. Thank you so much. We have another caller. Last four digits of phone number 0380. Are you there,
Ron,
to the caller? Okay,
yes,
what's
Pastor.
Your name and where are you calling from?
I'm Reverend Ron Marshall from Little Rock, Arkansas.
Oh, okay, yeah. You've called in before, right?
Sure, sure. Yes, sure have. And enjoyed every time, you know?
Okay. What do you have to add?
I think that, now, I don't mean to be critical or derogatory when I say this, but I think black people have concentrated on too much of what our white cousins think about us and feel about us. I don't think they have put enough into who they are, far as money is concerned, capital, educating one another. I don't think we've done enough of that. I think we got equality mixed up with living next door to Rockefeller or Lyndon B. Johnson or somebody, but not enough on what we're doing and our gifts, our talents, our side of town. Mm. We're more concerned about going where the money has been sent to away from us instead of building a desirable, visible picture in our own neighborhood and worrying about, you know, I think our issues is too much involved, in depth with our white cousins and wanting to mimic them adverse to building up and adverse to educating and adverse to sharing and investing in ourselves as a nation,
mm-hmm.
as other nations do. I think that's been a big, big, big part of our problem. Now, I don't condemn the civil rights leaders, you know what I mean? Because a lot of them
right.
was operating out of fear. They were being treated less than humans because they didn't understand the real reason why people was transported from the Ivory Coast through the Middle Passage to this Western Hemisphere. They didn't get the real story. But at any rate, now we must not focus so much in depth on our white cousins, but we should focus on people of color, other ethnicities, and working from a nation standpoint of view with these other nations of people. In other words, like the nations of our white cousins has a handle on the capital and so on and as such, well, we're gifted, we're talented, extremely brilliant-minded people. We should be able to put something together to bargain at the table with our white cousins, our Hispanic cousins, our Asian cousins, that we may mm-hmm. reap, you know, beyond this little thing where we are. Because right now, we're still battling with who's who and haves and the have-nots, while other nations mm-hmm. are banding together. They don't have no haves and have-nots. They're working for the good of all and for their legacy and for the perpetually generations coming behind, the perpetually moves other nation of people are doing. But we're yet, you know, trying to figure out who's who and the haves and the have-nots and sit with so-and-so, sit with them. Good, sit in fellowship. But then don't just go there, sit in fellowship and think that's your life and construct generation behind you. This is what you should do, and you're doing something, and really you're not doing anything.
May I address that,
go ahead.
Please? I have to disagree with a few of the things that you said. Please forgive my voice. It's not real good tonight. But I think that you have a few things backwards because they have, our white cousins have taken our fashion. They've taken our music. They've taken our hairstyles. They've even taken part of our religion. They have taken everything that they can. They even try to take our skin color. They spend hundreds and thousands of dollars to get dark like us. They spend much, much money to have hair like ours. Our fashion was always ours, and now they're doing it. Our dancing was always ours. Now they're doing it. So I don't believe that we are spending so much time looking after them. I think they are spending a lot of time looking after us, and I think that we still have obstacles just simply because we are black in this country, and there is still hatred, and the Ku Klux Klan did not disappear overnight. They're still here. They're judges, they're police officers, they're lawyers, they're teachers. They don't dress like that at school or in the courtroom, but you better believe they dress like that at night. We still have issues. But I don't think that we are trying to look and act and dance and dress like our white counterparts. I think that they are mimicking us. I guess that's all I got to say on that.
Well, you know, what you're saying, it holds truth. But the matter of it is, if they take something from you, you'll create it. So you can make something different. If they take what you or your genius has brought forth, then let them have that because you know then you could put out a product that they're going to buy. Now, the Ku Klux Klan still exists. But we got another Klans that's within our nation that's more dangerous than the Ku Klux Klan, and they're killing around the clock.
Okay, go ahead, Sandy.
I just wanted to mention that the American Society of Psychiatrists are now honoring PTSS as a syndrome. It's called post-traumatic slavery syndrome that affects blacks only. And that is something that causes self-hate, something that causes self-discrimination, and that is something that they are getting ready to put into law right now as we speak.
Well, the slaves are still being sold right today, too. You know that? You can buy.
Let me jump in here. I need to jump in here. Let's get Joe in here. Joe, you still with us?
Yep, still here. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Joe. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, I think he's right. I think black people should concentrate on moving forward by taking a look at the resources that they have available, taking a look at the history, taking a look at their the particular talents. I do think, however, when the gentleman was talking about fellowship with other nations, I guess what you were saying was to have fellowship with other ethnicities. You're going to find that the Asians and Hispanic communities are more prejudiced against blacks than whites are. And I also think that you believe that other nations globally really don't have a problem in being together, sitting down in fellowship, or coming together in international meetings, and that there's really no problem within each nation. Every nation has a problem with immigrants, including ours. And those immigrants are tearing apart the general inherent culture of those nations, of Germany, France, Spain, England, to mention those. So with regards to joining together with other people, as I've said, you're going to find, if that happens, and if you know people who have taught or tried to negotiate with Asians, with Hispanics will carry, they'll be on the coattails of black people, but they'll jettison you in a minute. Asians don't even want to be bothered with black people, period.
Well, I'm not.
How do I know?
Excuse me, Joe. I think y'all kind of miss what I was saying.
I'm talking about
in productivity. I'm not just talking when I say fellowship. I should have said fellowship. I should have said trade and business.
Oh, okay. All right.
Okay, guys, I'm going to step in here. Sandy, let's give you the last word, and then we're going to close out. Go ahead, Sandy.
Okay, the only thing that I have to say is that this was a beautiful, beautiful episode tonight, and we all learned about the people that have brought us to where we are right now, and we still have a long way to go, but we have people who put their own lives on the line to get us here, and we need to honor and appreciate what they have done by picking up the mantle and moving forward, and we can do that. I have a group on Facebook that's called Black Issues, and I asked everyone to please spend all of their holiday money with black companies to try to make a dent in what we're doing, because we do have economic power that we're not using. So basically, I just think that this was a very good discussion. It was good to have people other than just you and I, Janet, to have
definitely
people's opinions. I thought that was very good, and I just appreciate the fact that No one got upset because I sound like a horse tonight.
No, you did just fine. You did just fine.
You did just fine. Yes, yes.
And I,
all
and
right.
I thank you
well,
for
every...
the comment. Thank you for the comment that, yes, we need to do our shopping this year at doitallinthemall.com. We are a Black-owned company with people shopping and working with us from all different nationalities, and we help by you shopping in our different communities and make our lives better. So, yes, definitely shop with Black businesses, and you can find them on the Afrocentric page and doitallinthemall.com. Take it back over, Janet. Thank you.
Okay, everyone who called in tonight, please come back in 2 weeks. We welcome your calls. We'd like to hear what you have to say. So thank you to everyone who called in. Thank you, Sandy Norris, for helping out tonight. Special thanks to you for being with us. Now, I'm Janet Schwartz. You've been listening to Let's Do It Radio on the homepage of doitallinthemall.com. Stay tuned and enjoy the music. Come back and hear us. Come back and be with us in 2 weeks. Thank you. Good night.
reconciliation and peace. And let us be a holy nation where pride and prejudice shall cease. Let us speak the truth in love to the lost and least of these. Let us serve the Lord in unity so others will believe. Let us be the generation of reconciliation and peace. Reconciliation.